Exton Moss Experiment. Adventures in Wine and Space with Simon Exton and Ken Moss.
Hello everyone, and a very warm welcome to another edition of the Exton Moss Experiment. I'm Ken Moss.
I'm Simon Exton.
And tonight, what are we watching?
Tonight we're going to watch a wonderful piece of Nigel Neal television, The Year of the Sex Olympics.
Now, what is this about?
Right, so it was transmitted in colour on BBC Two on the 29th of July 1968, and it was in the Theatre 625 Strand on BBC Two. One of the first BBC productions we put out in colour. Colour originally started on BBC Two and then moved across to BBC One later on in the 60s, and was most output was colour by 1970. So this only exists as a black and white tele recording, which is a terrible shame because you can see from production photos and you can see from the production itself that it's very colour heavy. Mm. So I think we're missing quite a lot of this by not seeing it in colour.
Well, before we sit down and watch, should we have a little snifter?
A brightener.
It's time to get out the tonic screwdriver. You have got us a bottle today of Fino Dorée Manx Dry Gin, Elder She. It's 43%. Comes with a very pretty label on it. The infobox says, "Our Elder She edition, the folklore of the Isle of Man, tells of the fairies who dwell within the roots of the elder tree. In Manx Gaelic, the word she means both fairy and peace. Elder She celebrates the island's most magical of trees with heady floral notes of elderflower, the citrus tang of pink grapefruits, and lemon. The citrus tang of pink grapefruit and lemon, and herbal aromatics of lemon thyme and rosemary."
So very busy then.
It's a very woodland style bottle. Even the stoppers are sort of a cork with a wood swirl carved into it. Now there is a reason why you've picked this one for, isn't there?
Yes, because it's from the Isle of Man and Nigel Neal's from
mm-hmm, which I didn't know until you just said that.
It's nice and cloudy.
It is beautifully cloudy, and it smells really nice. That
really get the elderflower from the smell of it.
Well, I'm getting a tang of the lemon from that. Eyes down, dive in. Oh, now, the first thing that hits me is the lemon. I'm not overly fond of lemon. I have said this before. I'm not overly fond of lemon gins. And it's not that real sharp lemon, but it's enough just to nudge that into it. I'm going to give it a 4, but that's, I think, largely because of my own personal preferences rather than it being not 5 worthy. I suspect you're going to nudge this into 5 territory.
No, I'm not. I'm going to give this a 4. I mean, it's very nice. To me, the predominant flavour is the elderflower, although you can taste the lemon. I'm not getting any thyme or rosemary or anything out of it. It's just a little one note. There's no real depth to it.
I will give you that, yes.
It's nice. I like elderflower. Is it any different to a standard gin with an elderflower tonic? I don't think so.
That's not a bad appraisal, actually.
It's nice. I'm enjoying it, but it's not really interesting enough to push it into 5 territory.
You see, maybe it's just my palate is sensitive to the lemon because I'm not particularly keen on it. I would have preferred the elderflower to be much. In fact, for me, you could take all the lemon and citrus out of it and just have an elderflower gin. But it's beautifully presented, I will say that, and it looks great in the glass.
Yeah. It is a nice gin. It's just not an outstanding gin.
With that in mind, glass in hand, we shall descend into the under gallery at Podcasting House and open up the Black Archive. What have you got for us today that you're going to rescue?
With this, there's only one thing that can be rescued, and actually potentially can be rescued, and that's Year of the Sex Olympics in colour. And as I understand it, the tele-recording has the chroma dots, so a colour recovery is possible. So it's almost one for the gift shop.
Should we nip next door and get it on DVD? Colour recovery, I am really, really passionate about. It's no secret, we have mentioned it before. I think that a lot of black and white television that you see, I mean, particularly, you know, there's a lot of clips now of Doctor Who, the 60s Doctor Who that have been colourised, and they're getting it really. These are just fans that are doing this. It's not even industry professionals. Some of the Patrick Troughton stuff that's being put out, you know, there's clips from the War Games and the Mind Robber, which is a very... Mind Robber's got a lot of black and white in it. Even that, colourised, it just brings it all to life. And Year of the Sex Olympics, I'm vaguely familiar with prior to this, because it's one of those titles that's been bandied around over the years. I really should have seen it properly by now. Yes, that's one to be lifted from the gift shop. Well, mine is an actual Black Archive pick. This is Mrs. Wickens in the Fall. It's a 1957 piece. It's Nigel Neill's... It's his only other non-fantasy drama for television after the Quatermass serials.
And non-fantasy for the BBC.
Mm, yeah.
So that wouldn't include things like Kevin and QC.
The play, looking at the synopsis, the play is two ageing American tourists are placed in a small French town which is still scarred by German occupation after the Second World War. Set in 1956, just a decade after the war ended, the tourists Bob and Liddy Wickens encapsulate the ignorant parochial mindset that, rightly or wrongly, was thought to characterise post-war America. This is something that you, I suspect, will know a little bit more about than I do. I'm really just going off what I've been able to find online. Directed by Rudolf Cartier, who he's collaborated on a few things with Nigel Neill, didn't he?
Yes. Yeah. Quatermass, 1984, Arrow to the Heart.
The main characters have been speaking in BBC English and received pronunciation.
Even though they're American.
Even though they're American. So it's...
Hello, Paula. Yeehaw.
But apparently the characters in this particular play indicate a compelling mode of speech through faltering and gabbling. So that's to convey the character's humble simplicity, apparently. But it's a gap, and it's Nigel Neill, and we like Nigel Neill here at EME. So, yeah, that will be my pick. So here we are, back in the viewing room, and without further ado, it's Ron VT on the Year of the Sex Olympics.
All days, the world was totally randomised, all life.
True, true. Nobody knew what had happened next.
Maybe that they miss, deep down.
I don't know.
Lazy, you real madhead.
Why?
That picture of Cotty made, well, that was just like old days. It just upset him.
Oh, they got no feel if it not happened to me. That picture did happen to them.
True.
It hurt him.
Maybe you got onto something there, pal
OP. Shock him, but not upset him. Easy, how we do it.
And maybe randomized computers.
Suppose you've got just a few people to live like old days and watch them to make a show.
Rather from everywhere, like savages, like wild men.
But alone. Nobody ever tell them what to do. Nobody come near.
Not ever?
Not ever. Make their own food. Get things they need.
No help at all?
No.
The total risk?
Get sick, even die?
That'd be the show.
Do you want to give us a brief synopsis of what we've just watched?
Okay, so the action is set in the reasonably near future, and the population is divided into high-drive and low-drive people. And the high-drive people are working in television, and they work in television as a way of controlling the low-drive people. And the television producers have realised that rather than censoring things in terms of the amount of sex that they see, they've basically shown them everything. So all of television output is a kind of porn. So they have art sex and sports sex and the Sex Olympics, which is a TV extravaganza that the main characters, all of whom are working in this TV production, all are gearing up towards. The main character, Nat Mender, through a previous relationship, has a daughter who is in the official nurseries and is coming to the age where she's assessed to whether she's high drive or low drive, and she becomes assessed as low drive, which means that she would be sort of housed with the general population who do nothing but mindlessly watch the telly all day. He and his current partner are working in TV production, and his previous partner, Deanie, is seeing an artist who had been assigned to sort of designing backdrops for some of the art sex programs, but they were a bit too disturbing and distracted from what was on the television. And he has taken this art further and produced quite disturbing images of bloodstained corpses and wants these shown on the telly. So interrupt one of the sports sex programs by climbing up a rope and showing these pictures to the camera and saying, look, these pictures make you feel things. You have to see this. And while he's waving this at the camera and getting very excited, he falls off the rope, lands on the studio floor, dies. And the death is televised. And the audience are absolutely electrified by this, initially shocked and then laughing. And the TV producers, somewhat reluctantly led by Leonard Rossiter's character, decide that what they're going to do is show people real life. So they've got a remote Scottish island all set up for a group of people to go and live without the benefits of modern technology. And Nat volunteers to do this with Deanie and Ketton, who is their daughter, because otherwise their daughter is going to end up with the low drive personnel. They get onto the island. There's a little cottage there, but they've got to learn how to make fire and provide their own food and things. And they've got a tape machine, which will give them advice. They soon find out that they're not alone on the island and that there is another couple there. Initially, it's all very friendly, and the other couple are showing them how to live on the island, to collect gold's eggs. And it turns out that the other man on the island was sent there years previously for killing his partner during one of the sports sex performances. It was felt that he wasn't able to be rehabilitated, that he was too violent, so he was just put on this island. And he becomes psychotic. The daughter injures herself. And they don't know how to cure the injury. She gets an infection and she dies. The other man on the island, is his name Grells? Grells ends up killing Deanie, barricades himself into the cottage with her and kills her. Nat is able to break down the door and then kills Grells himself. That's quite a graphic scene with an axe.
I was quite surprised by that.
Yeah. And then it ends with Nat on his own. Grells has killed his partner, Betty, in the meantime. So Nat is the only survivor on the island. He's left distraught, alone on the island. Back in the studio, there is a huge celebration with Brian Cox's character taking the credit for this being a massive success. And they start planning the next series of the Live Life show. And Leonard Rossiter's character overseeing it is just in despair at the way things are going. And that's the end of it.
It's not a cheery watch. It's uncomfortable. That's looking at it from a 21st century perspective. That is an uncomfortable watch. Mary Whitehouse, Grandma Blowjob herself, was quite upset by it and tried to get... She got hold of a copy of the script, apparently, and went to Huey Green to try and stop this thing. And he was, no, I'm not going to stop this thing.
And there's some quite graphic stuff in it. The death of the artist and that axe attack doesn't leave anything to the imagination.
Well, in actual fact, the fall from the gantry or the ladder or what have you, it doesn't really spare your imagination, to be quite honest.
It would have been in colour. And there was a lot of Kensington gore around.
I mean, it's easily... This is not a... For all the sex that's referenced in it, and it's not a titillating film. For anyone that thinks that that hasn't seen it and thinks that it's some sort of basically softcore porn... It definitely isn't.
And even when they show the scenes of art sex and sports sex, it's all pretty mild.
But it's also the actors in it are all... They're all fairly awful. The characters, I mean, not the actual performances. They're all portrayed as these horrible, egotistical, basically influencers. There's no sympathy with any of the characters. The only one you feel vaguely sympathetic with is Leonard Rossiter, who, over the course of the play, realises that what he's overseeing is just morally repugnant, really, as it gets further and further. And in many ways, it echoes. The one thing that was brought to mind, I've often said this about Big Brother. When Big Brother started, way back when, 99, 2000, whenever it was, that first series was a real interesting social experiment. I must admit, I watched that with, a friend of mine.
That was Nasty Nick Bateman, wasn't it?
No, but this is before... Oh, was it, that might have been series one, actually.
Series one, because I have... Big Brother bores the crap out of me.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
It is a load of egotistical wannabes who shouldn't be given screen time.
But that's sort of where it ended up.
Right from the word... Because I watched some of... There was supposed to be some big drama about a showdown between nasty Nick Bateman and somebody else. And everybody I was working with at the time, because this is when I was working in the insurance company, everybody I was working with was obsessed with Big Brother and couldn't be asked. So I said that I would watch this one Big Showdown episode, and it bored the crap out of me. Because I've shared houses with dysfunctional people. I don't need to see quite how awful they can be. There was one other Big Brother thing that I watched, and there was a gay lad by the name of Shabazz who was just an utter attention-seeking drama queen. And he reminded so many friends of mine, of an ex of mine, that they said, you've got to watch this. It is your pointless ex. And I watched it, and it was. So the Big Brother phenomenon, actually the whole reality television thing, kind of.
That's where I was going. I don't do reality TV. It's just, it bores the hell out of me. They are all. But the original Big Brother idea, the original series, you watch this, and in those days, the very first series, it was just a group of people in a house. As the series progressed, they started dropping in the candidates, you know, a bit left of centre, you know, a bit off the wall. I think the second series they had Brian Dowling in it, who was irritating as fuck, is the mildest I can.
Can you win it?
Probably, yes. But he was, you know, he was the token gay one. But he wasn't just gay. He was gay and outrageous and a little bit awful with it. And then, where can we push the envelope further? So as the series went on, they started introducing more and more of this freak show. They weren't ordinary people anymore. They had to tick the boxes and, we'll get somebody who is awful. We'll get somebody who's a model and a huge ego, etc., etc. We'll get somebody who is just monumentally awful until you end up with what it turned into, which was just a house full of freaks. These are not real people at all. They're a house full of performers who know very well what they're going into. So inevitably, stuff like that's got a shelf life.
I know a couple of people who applied to go on to Big Brother, but all of them are circus performers.
Yeah, I was going to say, are these people you actually want to mate around with?
Yeah, very good friends, but performers who were planning to use it to boost their career.
I could not imagine anything worse than being in there. If you're that desperate to get your face known for being surrounded by nine other freaks who are all there for exactly the same reason, there's nobody's in there to be nice to each other. It's who can be the biggest arsehole on camera, who can create drama, who can cop off with somebody, all for your brief flicker in the spotlight. Oh, no, 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 no.
None of the people I knew got onto it. I think possibly because it was a little too obvious what they were aiming to use the exposure for. But this predicted that
way ahead, 30 years
ahead of time.
This should be
the same way that the machine stops predicted the internet.
Yes, and mobile phones and the complete reliance on technology.
And that was sort of 80 years ahead of time.
Oh, yeah, because Machine Stops, that was 1909 or something. It was written a long time before it was even filmed.
Even when it was done on Out of the Unknown episode, which would only have been a couple of years before this, that was a 60-year-old story at the time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it surprised me when we actually did that episode of Out of the Unknown, reading up on the backstory of it. For the 60s, it was quite a modern idea to find that it'd been written at the turn of the century.
And watching it now, you could imagine, the black and white dates it, and its pacing is a little slow. But if you were to restage The Machine Stops with very few changes, it would really appeal to a modern audience, because the modern audience would be able to completely understand the social media references. Actually, both The Machine Stops and The Year of the Sex Olympics, as you say, completely predicted influences. Mm.
It's just an uncomfortable watch. I think the scenes on the island in particular,
which is interesting. It was supposed to be a Scottish island, and they talk about that in the play. It was actually all filmed on the Isle of Man.
Really?
Yes.
I did not know that.
I believe at Nigel Neal's request, because his hometown. I've only ever once been to the Isle of Man, and that was only to because there used to be a sort of hopping plane service between Belfast and Blackpool. It used to do a hop onto Douglas. So you'd do Belfast, Douglas, Blackpool, and then back the same way. So I have technically
been to the Isle of Man.
Been to the Isle of Man, but it was on a plane and I never got out of the plane.
I've been to the Isle of Man a few times. It's not something that's going on my CV. It is like travelling back in time. I remember going to a bar in Douglas called the British or the Britannia or something like that. It was a very anglicised pub. All the music was early 90s rave, like The Shaman and Prodigy and Two and
Move,
but all the actual songs from the time, all the kids in there were singing and dancing word perfect to stuff that was brought out in the early 90s. And you think, you've clearly heard this a lot. Within the last 10 years.
Right, okay.
Unless the 90s is now their 70s, because there was a lot of 70s stuff that I used to know in the 90s, but even so, it just seemed a little odd.
There was a lot of 60s stuff being played in the 80s when I was a kid, so I knew quite a lot of 60s, and apart from the fact that it was my parents' record collection that I was able to. So I knew pretty much the whole of the Beatles back catalogue by the time I was 12 or 13, because...
Of your parents. I mean, and yeah, much the same as me with my mum and dad's. They had boxes and boxes of singles. That was my first introduction to Sparks. This town ain't big enough for the both of us.
I like Sparks.
Yeah.
Very good live. Or were very good live. I don't know if they're still touring.
Anyway, don't go to the Isle of Man, boys and girls. There's nothing there, apart from one very good pub in Foxdale called The Baltic. And you drive past it and it looks like a hellhole. It's one of the most welcoming, lively pubs I've ever been to in my life, but it only comes to life after 11 o'clock at night. So, back to Nigel Neal.
The Isle of Man, to be honest. But it sounds a bit like going to Wales. You go for the scenery, right?
It's nothing like going to Wales because the people on the Isle of Man are friendly.
Ah, right. Nothing like Wales then.
Nothing like Wales. The year of the Sex Olympics. Yeah, never go to Wales. Never. I've made a vow. Every now and again, I do find myself back in Wales.
There is utterly beautiful scenery in Wales.
Mm-hmm.
If you get beyond the fact that the people there don't want you there and make it very clear that they don't want you there, you can argue that honesty is refreshing, but I'd prefer to my holiday time and my holiday money.
Holiday money, yes.
Going somewhere that we are actually welcome. Not sure where that is at the moment. Not anywhere in Europe, I suspect.
Europe is very welcoming. It always has been, and it still is. Listen, don't make the mistake.
I'm not talking Brexit with this. I'm talking coronavirus because...
Oh, I see what you mean. Ah,
because
right.
We have, by an order of magnitude, the highest infection rates in Europe.
But we are... we're not doing too bad. In terms of freedoms, we're doing a lot better than most countries on the continent. The other countries are in panic compared to the UK. Just to give some context to this, we're talking in July 2021.
We're in Freedom Week.
We are in... I really hate the term Freedom Day. It's so American, and it's clearly been created for a hashtag. The media in Britain love painting a terrible picture. If you listen to the news, you know, with this plague-ridden hellhole that everybody has shunned, in actual fact... Every country is treating every other country exactly the same. This is nothing new. I think the only one that's buried its head in the sand for quite a long time was America, and now that they've got a decent president, they are sort of pulling themselves out of it.
Sweden didn't put any lockdown in place, and the Swedish government have come out and said that was a big mistake.
Mm.
Because there's a lot of the anti-lockdown protesters who say, look at Sweden, they didn't put any lockdown in place, they're no worse off than the rest of us. And two things about that. Firstly, the Swedish government have said, yeah, we didn't put any lockdown in place and it was a mistake. And secondly, Sweden has a sensible population who will do the sensible thing for the most part. And if you look at what they didn't actually need a lockdown because the population did it for themselves.
And looping back,
that's going to do that.
The British is 55 million cats that don't want to be herded. That's just in England. So Britain as a population, I've always argued that we cannot be trusted as a nation. This is why I argue against things like the legalisation of cannabis.
But just because it's not for me doesn't mean that I don't think it should be not available for people who do prefer it to alcohol.
I'm on the fence.
I'm not. I'm pro-legalisation of cannabis. I don't think it's something that should necessarily be first step into legalisation of all drugs.
I don't hear that argument at all. I don't see that argument.
You hear that argument from the anti-campaigners. And this will be the first step in legalisation of hard drugs. No, it wouldn't.
We've gone a long way off topic, although strangely it is on topic. But that is one thing that I hate from any anti-campaigners of anything. It's all based on fear rather than rationale. That I despise that with a passion.
Yeah, and actually one of the themes of the year of the Sex Olympics is... push it as much of what the public want at them and they'll become sort of hypnotised and bored by it. Now, unless it's talking about pornography and you have it on screen all the time, you're fascinated and transfixed, but actually kind of hypnotised and bored by it at the same time.
The sort of the underlying theme, particularly when, again, getting back to the campaigner falling off the gantry, we can push the envelope in a different direction. This is something else for the audience. We can push it further.
And there's a really nice speech from Leonard Rossiter's character about how this system was set up, and there were wars and a lot of social unrest. The powers that be realised that you would be able to, rather than prohibiting what people could see, you would be able to just show them everything, and it would calm them down and kind of keep them under control and bored.
Which isn't a million miles off what we have now.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was a very forward-thinking piece. I won't say that I loved it, because it was...
It's really thought-provoking.
It is very thought-provoking and an uncomfortable watch. I will say that over and over. Leonard Rossiter, just coming on to him as a Brian Cox, he's very young and very...
He's very smooth.
He is. He's very smooth.
With glossy hair.
And it's barely
glossy.
Well, he's barely recognisable as Brian Cox, because now he's 70s now, I think. And I struggle to think that, because he's been
must be older than that.
He's on Desert Island Disc last year, I think, or maybe the year before. 2020 has just sort of been a gap year. I've edited it out. But he was on, and what a fascinating man.
Do you know, I've realised that me mistaking about gap year. I thought I was quoting from The Windsors. I'm not.
You're not?
It's from one of the Charles Paris audios, played by Bill Nighy, an ageing alcoholic actor who gets caught up in murder mysteries. They're a joy to listen to, because I have the whole series. I absolutely love them.
For anyone who is interested in audio dramas, audio comedies, radio, we do another podcast called Oral Intercourse, and I shall do a little plug there and move back to Year of the Sex Olympics, because we are good at going down rabbit holes. But Leonard Rossiter is one of those people, only ever see him as Rigsby, and he is absolutely straight, and this is a straight role. And you see the range of the man.
Have you seen the one where he played the machine gunner?
No.
He was a debt collection agent, and the reason he was nicknamed the machine gunner was because of how violently he would rap on people's doors and things. It's really grim, sort of 70s.
I'm just trying to think back. Actually, I don't know whether I'm misremembering this, but there was a one-off play, and it's on a DVD of... I've got Ripping Yarns in my head, but I think I might be making that up. It was written by Michael Palin and Terry Jones, I think, and it's a one-off play that I've mentioned before called Secrets.
Yeah, that's on the Ripping Yarns thing. It's the one with Warren Mitchell.
Warren Mitchell, that's it, yes. So it's nothing to do with Leonard Rossiter at all. But again, another man who's known for comedy, but straight roles.
He's known for Ralph Garnett.
He's known for Ralph Garnett, exactly, but when you see him in straight roles, you see the range of the man.
Yeah, and actually another one who is absolutely superb when you see her away from comedy is Uta Joyce.
Really?
You think of her as pure George and Mildred and the dragon roll and all of that. Seen her in a Shakespeare, and she was really, really good. Nothing at all like Mildred. Some of the, and particularly the comedy established actors in the 70s. I didn't realise this until, was it the Sophie Aldred interview that we had on one of the previous episodes, where comedy performers got paid more.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Than drama performers. So once you got into comedy, you stayed in comedy because you had you made a better living out of it. So that's why you have very good actors such as Leonard Rossiter, Warren Mitchell, Jeffrey Palmer, all of these people who are predominantly known for their comedy roles. But when you see them in the occasional straight role in something, they're brilliant.
Mm. I far preferred Leonard Rossiter in a straight. He's the menace coming out of the man.
I like Rising Damp.
Oh, no, not to deride Rising Damp. It's a lovely, fluffy series, and he plays a great character in it. But certainly in this, he's... That sharpness to his performance. And
and there were some really nice touches towards population control, not just of the low drive people, but of the high drive as well. So they're very much pushed towards the career that is right for them from a very early age. I mean, Ketton was, they're saying she was 9 when they were making the decision about whether she was high drive or low drive. She was certainly very young.
Yeah, but even then, it was drilled into the kid that, you know, you're going to be this way. And it's basically programming the populace.
Absolutely. And there was the whole thing about the wall dispensers for the brighteners. And
these
tube things. And there's one scene where Leonard Rossiter's character is saying, it doesn't matter how many of these you drink, you don't get anything more than a buzz.
So, I'm constantly surprised when we watch these things, how far ahead of their time they are, particularly the 60s stuff. But when you get to the 70s, they're becoming a little more self-aware, messagey, preachy. The 60s stuff, particularly all this sort of out-of-the-unknown-esque
The 60s kind of, for British television, kind of hits that sweet spot. Mm. Because up until the 50s, it's been theatre in a little box. Everything that was put out on television was an adaptation of theatre or magazine programmes or kids' programmes.
Sort of, but when the dramas and a lot of the films at the time, certainly through the 50s and to an extent into the 60s and mid-60s really, there was a lot of war fear.
The television was still theatre-based. I mean,
agreed, yeah.
You look at any of the plays that survive pre-Quatermass Experiment, and Quatermass Experiment was really the tipping point.
Yes.
That was the first serialised drama that was specifically written for a television audience. It is a crying shame we only have the first two episodes because they are works of brilliance. Now, don't get me wrong, I love some of the theatre adaptations, some of the stuff that comes through in the Armchair Theatre strand. It's still, even into the 70s, designed as theatre pieces that are put out on television, and some of them are wonderful.
Yeah, I think so. I seem to remember somewhere stashed in the Exton Moss filing drawer at Podcasting House, there is a couple of discs worth of Armchair Theatre, and I think...
I've got all the ones that Network have put out.
Yeah.
And Network, if you're listening, please, 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 more Armchair Theatre. And particularly, I Can Destroy the Sun.
I'm going to give another plug here to Network. Again, a little off topic. They put out stuff they can't be making much money out of. And they are the most glorious releases. Lovingly presented, restored as far as they can. It's
wonderful,
just...
Wonderful stuff. And yeah, it's geeks like us that will buy them. Something like Undermined or Spider's Web, they can't do more than a few hundred in their sales.
I wouldn't have thought so. Having been in years gone by, I was in DVD production, and they are pence to produce. What, if you do a print run of 1,000, you're talking about 50p to actually produce a DVD with a printed sleeve, shrink wrapped and everything ready to go. You've still got to outlay. That's £1,000 for a print run. And then you've got all the costs of actually mastering the thing, finding the thing. So it's not a cheap thing to produce a DVD.
And actually, the other thing that Network have done is they've done really good stuff in terms of archive recovery as well.
Oh, absolutely.
So when we did It's Dark Outside, we got to see a couple of episodes from season two with Anthony Ainley. Now, up until the point where they were prepping for the DVD release, those episodes weren't known to exist. Mm. And they thought they were just going to be issuing the whole of season one, which is wonderful. Oh, God.
I've watched the whole thing.
There's some wonderful stuff in there as well.
I say I've watched the whole thing. I've not got to the end because I know that you've said that there's a character twist right at the end and it changes the whole landscape of the second series. I've not. I've got about six episodes in, I think. I think there are eight in the series. So that's a lie. But...
Oh, you need to. It is wonderful. It is a real beautifully done fall from grace. I mean, if you watched up until to a few episodes before the end, you'll be starting to get indications of it. And you probably know who the fall from grace character is. I'm not going to tell you.
No. I think, we are now however many episodes in to Exton Moss Experiment. I think it's probably come across. We really, really love archive telly. The 60s in particular is just a gold mine.
We've been doing this for 16 years, 2005.
Yeah, 2005,
We met at the screening of Rose because Ken was trying to hit on my sister who'd come along at the time.
Neither me nor Sam remember this, but apparently you do.
Sam remembers it.
She does not lie.
She does.
Certainly.
It's stunningly attractive, so
yes.
I can't fault your taste on that one.
Putting that to one side, but no, we have watched some glorious stuff over the years. I mean, one of my earliest memories with you is Our House. This is less Year of the Sex Olympics and more a sort of... Exton Moss Experiment. Yeah, Exton Moss Experiment.
Retrospective.
Yes. But
even though we haven't done an episode on Our House yet.
The one that I still gush about as a DVD release is Little Us Robot.
Well, that's BFI.
Right? It is, but...
Year of the Sex Olympics was BFI as well.
And again, a shout out to the British Film Institute. They put stuff out on DVD. It is so... lovingly put out. I mean, things come out. It's literally one episode of a series. One episode. And a couple of audio recordings that are ropey quality. And this lavish full... I mean, a booklet doesn't really do it justice.
It's a book.
It's a book that comes with this DVD. You get the option to watch the original copy of it and then a remastered version that's vid-fired. An entire DVD release around one episode. I am just astounded by the love that goes into these things. Yeah. But also heartened by it. We are so lucky. Particularly now, and the Doctor Who, the Blu-ray stuff.
And some of the other stuff that the BBC puts out there. The extras that you get on the Omega Factor. Wonderful.
It's ridiculous.
The Out of the Unknown DVD is just beautifully
done. Yeah.
The Adam Adamant Lives.
Oh, Adam Adamant. Our third anniversary special, we looked at Adam Adamant Lives, which I, up until that point, had only seen a repeat of the pilot episode on BBC Four, I think, for some retrospective night in the.
And it's one of those shows where the pilot episode isn't the best.
It isn't, but I was hooked. I was absolutely
really
hooked by this.
Its own after that, you need to watch a few episodes of the first series to really get a feel for how the show is before you watch the absolute showstopper that is Black Echo.
That's the one where his past catches up with him, isn't it?
That is just a phenomenal episode of television.
It's not often that I am genuinely blown away by any of the series that we watch. We watch a lot of really good stuff. Periodically, something comes along where I adore it. Adam Adamant Lives, that is one of those. You've lent me the full set, and I love it. I love it. It's just so... I can't understand why... I mean, somebody had to lose. It was the BBC version of The Avengers, or their answer to The Avengers. And The Avengers won out. And looking at the two of them, actually, Adam Adamant is a much better series.
I wouldn't say much.
I
think they're both,
it's
I think
a better
they're both
series.
Superb. I think there would have been room for both to continue and thrive. Adam Adamant, looking at the other surviving episode of the second season, which is one of the poorest that survive. It's Sinister Sort of Service, and
Don't think I've seen it yet.
There are only two surviving episodes
from
the second season of Adam Adamant. Sinister Sort of Service was actually the other thing that was found in the cupboard at Villiers' house.
With Ice Warriors.
The four episodes of the Ice Warriors were found.
Wasn't that found in a can of Doctor Who? Isn't? Yeah, it was.
Wasn't it the one that was labelled Colony of Devils, which was the original production title for Fury from the Deep?
Yeah.
So there was a lot of conspiracy at the time that Fury from the Deep had been recovered as well as the Ice Warriors, and the BBC were keeping it quiet for whatever unknown reason.
We have gone a very, very long way off topic.
This episode is turning into a love letter to British telefantasy, particularly British telefantasy of the 60s. Now, as Ken says, it's not a surprise that we're big fans of this. And the brilliance and the imagination and the foresight of 60s TV when it got it right is absolutely encapsulated in the year of the Sex Olympics.
I'm trying to think now of an example, because we have watched some bad TV. Give me an example of 60s TV that's bad. There's some that's less compelling than others. There's some that, you know, it looks a little bit stilted by modern standards. Give me an example of something we've watched that is bad, or even something we've not watched for EME. But I'm struggling here.
Some of the comedy stuff is very dated.
But is it bad?
You watch things like The Rag Trade, it's very much of its time. Counter-Strike was a bit dull, but again, that was of its time, and I think they're quite interesting plots. They're just very slow.
The poorly executed, I would say. Counter-Strike, there's only the third episode with David Jason on the ice cap. I enjoyed it, I think, more because David Jason was in it, but...
I like the Dream Sequences episode. I know we've not done The Prisoner yet, but that was basically a remake of A, B, and C. It's not bad, it's just not as good as other stuff that we've watched.
Whether there's an element of rose-tinted glasses here for a period that I wasn't even alive for, but I'm struggling to think of something in the 60s. It was out and out bad. Even the Corridor People is not good. The Corridor People is dreadful.
Corridor and People is wonderful.
We are on very different sides of the coin here. I tell a lie. When was Curry and Chips?
69. Oh, God. Yeah, that was
that
bad.
That was bad.
That was,
that
very,
was bad.
Very bad.
That is easily the worst thing I've ever profaned my DVD player with. That was awful.
I previously managed to get halfway through that first episode. I know for our 30 millionth Brexit episode, we managed to get through the entire first episode. and it was painful. Yes, curry and chips. Okay, that is not a recommendation.
We found an episode. We found an example of 60s TV that's bad. But Year of the Sex Olympics, as with a lot of stuff that we've watched, is quite forward thinking.
I think this makes a really good companion piece to The Machine Stops.
That was where I was going with this. Yeah,
they're both very forward thinking. They're both very predictive. I think Year of the Sex Olympics could be remade now and have relevance to a modern audience in the same way.
If they didn't fuck about with it. I hate the fact that when they remake stuff, they fuck about with it. Look at...
Marple. Oh, God, I hate Marple so much because they fuck about with the plot.
Well, I've not seen any. I don't, because no one's ever going to replace Joan Hickson. Those BBC adaptations were...
To be fair, Geraldine McEwan puts in a superb performance.
Oh, I'm not talking about the performances.
No, my problem with it is the script, and they bugger about with the script, and they turn her into a...
Isn't she a lesbian or something? Yes. Just fuck off.
And they'll change who the murderer is.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
How does that fucking work?
It doesn't. And what they haven't twigged is that people watching Agatha Christie already know what the plot is. Agatha Christie fans have read all the books. Actually, it's not just Marple, because there have been some horrifically bad adaptations on the BBC. They did Pale Horse recently with Rufus Sewell. It was awful.
On the flip side of that coin, and then there were none. It was a couple of years ago. It wasn't a bad one.
It came out about the same time as they did a superb version of An Inspector Calls. I love my JB.
Yeah. I've been in a few JB pieces of plays, and
I'm really, really disappointed that nobody has done a decent version of Dangerous Corner. I love
it. Haven't they?
No. There was a TV version that I remember from when I was a teenager. It must have been the 80s. I've not been able to find hide nor hair of it, other than the fact that it was my first introduction to Dangerous Corner and the first time that I saw it. There is a film from the 1940s. That is only available in a Spanish print. I would love somebody to redo that, because it is a wonderful play. I actually prefer it to An Inspector Calls.
Good grief.
I love all three of his time plays, because there's An Inspector Calls, there's Dangerous Corner, and there's Time in the Conways. And all three of them are wonderful. I don't think Time in the Conways has ever been done on telly.
It's not one I'm familiar with. Appallingly.
Those are his three time plays, because they all play about with the concept of time. Dangerous Corner is wonderful. It starts off as a very stilted family scene, and then tiny little comments unpick this whole tissue of lies. It is beautifully done. It's an absolute masterpiece of playwriting. Possibly his best piece of writing. I prefer it to Inspector Calls. Now, the recent BBC adaptation of Inspector Calls is wonderful. They've done Inspector Calls, they've done that, and then There Were None, which is the best adaptation.
It is, because it doesn't fuck about with it.
Utterly brilliant. And they've done Witness for the Prosecution, which was very good. On the other side of the coin, they've done Crooked House, which is one of her best novels, and fucked that up.
Really? Oh, God, I hate...
They fucked it up by just making it unbearably slow. It's like the Kenneth Branagh version of Murder on the Orient Express. It is just slowed down to the point of tedium.
Just on that note... Mm. Boys and girls at home, I'm sorry that we have talked virtually nothing about Year of the Sex Olympics.
I think we talked a fair bit about it.
We have, but this has been a probably our most rambling episode to date. But I'm going to throw into the mix here The War of the Worlds. Have you seen that horrific...
The Tom Cruise?
Oh, no, the Tom Cruise one I actually quite like.
I wanted to rip my eyes out.
The BBC three-part miniseries. Everybody that was involved with that, you want putting up against a wall and shooting through the face.
I have heard such bad stuff about it from everybody whose opinion that I rate. I think I've got it around somewhere.
Oh, don't bother.
We will do it as an episode.
Fucking hell, that is going to be profane. There's not a Wine Vortex warning that is strong enough for the language I will use during that episode. The first episode, you think, okay, slightly different take on it. You've moved it to the Edwardian era, no problem. And then the thing goes woke as fuck. And then episode 3 is so meta, I don't know what to think, but it was the visual equivalent of adapting for television, watching paint dry. It's awful. Monumentally awful.
Did you see the remake of The Day of the Triffids, the one with Eddie Izzard?
No.
It's awful. It's absolutely. Eddie Izzard, DeGray Scott. Oh, dreadful.
That's absolutely a lie. Dreadful. Was that the one about 10 years ago?
Yes.
Yeah, I do remember seeing it, where they were, spoiler coming up, the way they beat the Triffids in the original is with salt water. I remember watching, in fact.
No, it isn't. No. In the original, so the novel, which the 1980s John Dettine fairly closely mirrors, they don't beat the Triffids. They just end up living with them.
Oh, I've not seen that for years.
The Howard Keel film, they beat them with salt water, but that's not the original book ending. Day of the Triffids, I absolutely love it. That and The Nightmare Man were on round about the same time. I love them both so much that after the first episode, I went to my local library and got the book that each was based on.
I remember you saying, but I watched Day of the Triffids because I was ill with mumps at the time. And I was very young because I think
I was three.
But I remember, in my mind's eye, I remember vividly seeing one of the sort of pistols out of one of the Triffids stinging somebody across the face or the neck or something. And all these years later, that's the only thing I remember. Because you've sent me...
You didn't just see it in an advert for it.
Possibly, but it was late at night. Either way, it was not...
It wouldn't have been late. I think it would have been sort of 8 o'clock, something like that.
For a three-year-old, that's late.
See, I'd have been 12 at that point.
So having gone an awful long way off topic, an awful long way, and had a lovely, beautiful ramble through the 1960s archives, I am going to bring this to a close.
I would just say I'm not sure we've actually been off topic, because the Year of the Sex Olympics is an absolute one-episode encapsulation of what is so wonderful about 60s sci-fi television. And we've compared it to The Machine Stops, and we've talked about the impact that it had and how predictive it was in terms of...
modern culture.
Yeah.
21st century culture. Yeah. 50 years in advance.
And we talked about its brilliance and its prescience, and all of that is absolutely true. So rather than seeing it as rambling, it's just recognizing quite how prescient and encapsulating this is of everything that is wonderful about 60s television.
Yeah, absolutely,
and
agreed.
By extension, everything that we started doing the Exton-Moss experiment for. A work of brilliance. I think that phrase is sometimes overused, but absolutely not in these circumstances.
There are four words that I think that are overused. Love, hate, impossible, and genius. And genius is the one where it's often massively misattributed.
Whereas
this is love. Honestly, it is so far ahead of its time. I can't actually... having said that, I was about to say, I can't imagine a lot of the audience in 1969 looking at this and thinking, this is wonderful, marvellous. I imagine a lot of audiences, so a lot of 1960s television is the most terrible shit, actually, because it's, what's this nonsense? Why is it not theatre in a box?
I'm not sure. I think that would be true of the 1950s. I think by the 1960s, I've called it the sweet spot of television before, because there was coming in experimental stuff. So you've got the Corridor People, you've got the Strange World of Gurney Slade, you've got the more experimental episodes of Armchair Theatre, you've got television producers saying, well, what can we do with this? For God's sake, you've got An Unearthly Child. And all of the experimental stuff that those first years of Doctor Who did. So Web Planet, you can't imagine anything other than the Hartnell era, where for those first few years they were finding their feet and what can we do? How can we experiment? We've got episode of the week stories like The Keys of Marinus or The Chase. We do big sprawling epics like their Dalek Master Plan. We do the historical drama with the Aztecs and the Reign of Terror, but we also do the historical comedy like the Romans, the Gunfighters and the Mythmakers. It's certainly the first couple of years of Doctor Who. You can look and see every
avenue explored.
Every different story is an experimentation in a style. And
Even The Edge of Destruction, which I don't like, but how they...
See, I really like The Edge of Destruction.
No, you see, I can't...
In the same way as I like the first episode of The Mind Robber.
Again, Mind Robber episode one is a necessity. And
so is Edge of Destruction.
It was. It was, you know, we need to fill a gap. The scripts aren't ready for Marco Polo. And I look at it and I don't like it, but you look at some of the 1960s stuff, and I will keep harking back to Monty Python. I am not a fan of the Monty Python TV series. I love the films. I love the films. The Monty Python TV series is either flashes of brilliance or deeply shit. And you look at it and you think, what is going on screen? And how did anyone approve this?
Yeah. And again, do not adjust your set. Okay, it's a kids' program, but it's a bloody weird kids' program.
It is.
And all the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band stuff is bonkers. Massively entertaining bonkers.
Yeah, yeah.
But bonkers. By the time you were coming out of the 60s, you were going into the 70s, TV was seen as a product, something that was going into everybody's houses. When we were talking about Round the Horn for the oral intercourse episode, we were saying that it was the last time that radio was the big thing before giving way to television. So by the time the 1970s were coming along, television was in most households.
Yeah.
It was the main medium for entertainment. It was where people were making careers. The experimentation was going by that stage.
It was, but you look at some of the 60s stuff and you think, how did you even make this? Because it's so off the wall. You wouldn't try that even now. You would put that on screen.
Before it was seen as the predominant thing. It was getting to be a bigger audience. It was finding its feet. And find your feet with experimentation. The other thing about 60s television, and to an extent 70s television, but certainly 60s television, is that they expected their audience to think.
That is true, yes, which they don't now.
You watch pretty much all of the Out of the Unknowns from the 60s. You watch Year of the Sex Olympics. You need to concentrate on what's going on, and you need to draw conclusions. And you're given all the information to draw those conclusions. Audiences in the 60s had to think. No, I mean, not for every. I mean, okay, Coronation Street and sitcoms and things like that is you're led through a journey and you don't have to think about it too much, and it's more reactive. But things like this, things like the Out of the Unknown, speculative fiction, some of the Dennis Potter stuff and the Armchair Theatre strands. There was Harold Pinter. There were a lot of writers who expected their audience to be able to think and be able to draw conclusions from the things that they were writing, so they didn't have to write absolutely everything in there. Now, you compare that to 30 years later with Twin Peaks, where it is deliberately...
obscure.
It's deliberately obscure, and to be able to understand what is going on, you have to have the director's commentary. Now, that, to my mind, is lazy writing.
Twin Peaks, I adored at the time because I was swept up in the whole hype at the time. I was precisely the right age for Twin Peaks. I remember watching it from school, and to be fair, I remember watching a lot of it because the girl I fancied at school was into it. But I found myself swept along with it, and I really did enjoy it. But in the intervening years, you have called it The Emperor's New Clothes, and it's a very, very apt description.
It is, because to understand Twin Peaks, there is stuff that isn't on the screen that you have to be told this is what the director was aiming for. Well, if you have to give extra information to understand what the director was aiming for or what the writer was planning, they haven't done their job properly. Now, I'm not saying that everything should be spoon-fed. So films like Memento, where you have to watch the screen, you have to concentrate on what's going on, you will get more out of it with a second watching. All of that I absolutely love, but with something like Memento, there is everything there that you need to be able to work out what is going on in the plot. You have to concentrate. You can't watch it with half a brain, but you have everything on screen, whether you realise it or not, and sort of subtle background stuff that you only pick up on subsequent viewings, you have everything on screen to be able to understand that plot. Something like Twin Peaks, where you need to know that the director was thinking this and this and this and this. Well, if the director was thinking that, there should be reference to it on screen to work out what's going on. And if you've got the original Twin Peaks was about 38 million episodes or something.
It was only two episodes of, I don't think they were massively long series. I think they were, I don't even think they were the 22.
No, 8 or 10 or something like that. But something like The Killing.
Not seen.
Oh, really good. But it was one of those Scandi Noir things that was then adapted as an American show.
Right, yeah, like Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
About 10 episodes.
Right.
And it's not until you get to the end of season 2 that you really understand exactly what's happened right the way through the plot. That was fine. Right. That I really enjoyed because a load of mysteries thrown up in first episode and then further mysteries that come along. So some things are resolved and understood. Some things are made less clear. But by the time you get into the end of the second season, you know exactly what the entire plot is. You've come to the end of the novel. It makes sense. Twin Peaks, it's, there you go, there's a novel, but actually you need this second thing to be able to understand that novel.
Well, I was going to say, we waited 30 years between seasons 2 and 3 of Twin Peaks. That was ended on a cliff. I've not seen the most recent series of Twin Peaks, so I don't know, but it was all a bit, just run with it. Yeah. Don't try and, just run with it. Yeah. Run with the spectacle.
It's pretty, you don't have to understand it, patronising pat on the head. Fuck off. I have a brain. I can actually understand some really quite complex concepts. Give me the tools to be able to do that. Twin Peaks doesn't do that. And now, I've recently reread Ulysses, you know, James Joyce. I don't enjoy it.
They are turgid books. Let's not dick about here.
But you go into it knowing that it's a very complex book. He says that he deliberately wrote it as a very complex book that you have to concentrate on, and it's full of puzzles. I've read it twice, and each time I've done an online course at the same time to understand what has been happening.
Is that not just an interpretation of it, though?
Well, of course it's an interpretation.
Yeah, I know. But
what we do in the Exodemos experiment is an interpretation.
What I mean is it not just, I'm trying to think of a Doctor Who example where somebody is looked at. Okay, let's take Ben and Polly. Ben is gay. It's an interpretation. It's never explicitly referenced on screen.
And it's a modern interpretation.
It's a modern interpretation. So working your way through. But if somebody was to interpret, one person was to interpret Ulysses, that's their take on it. It may not be the definitive take.
There is a definitive reading of any book, but that's a very personal thing.
Mm.
So you and I both read the Terence Dicks novelisation of Imogen Fendall. We're going to get exactly the same thing out of it because it's a very prescriptive read. You and I both read the Agatha Christie. We're going to get exactly the same out of it because there's no real interpretation
that
needs to go into it.
I'm going to throw the ultimate grenade on the table. Finnegan's fucking Wake.
Which I haven't read.
You won't read it, and I'll tell you why. It is the only book I have ever picked up and said, this is unreadable. It's like all the deleted scenes from everything you've ever had put together in one compendium. No context. It's nonsense. Finnegan's Wake is unreadable. I will say this over and over again. Boys and girls, read a sample chapter online. It's been interpreted as this colossus of, you know, this is what the author was clearly going through, a dark time. It was an alcoholic or he had mental problems. It's all splashed onto the page writ large. A word is yet to be imagined that can convey the sheer magnitude of its enormity. It's bollocks.
It's really easy to make up bollocks like that. I used to do this quite a lot because when I was living in Belfast, I used to be part of a writing group. And one of the other members of the writing group was a local artist. So she used to get invites to the openings of gallery shows. And the opening of a gallery show always has free booze. And they were almost always on a Thursday evening, which is when our writing group used to meet. So we would meet at a fantastic bookshop called No Alibis, owned by a lad called Dave, who particularly crime novels knows inside out and backwards. And I used to go in and say, recommend me a book. And he never recommended me a bad book. I used to go in and say, my sister likes reading this, 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 and this. Oh, right, okay, these are the authors you want to introduce her to. He was never wrong. If you are ever anywhere near Belfast, check out No Alibis Bookshop on Botanic Avenue. Ask for Dave. He will be able to point you in the right direction of a book that you will love. So we used to do this writing group. We'd have a couple of bottles of wine between us, and then we would go to these gallery openings where there would be the artist wanting praise. And the cost, the price of the free alcohol was praise for the artist. So I got very, very good at talking bollocks about art, to the point where I actually got invited to quite a big gallery opening thing in the Waterfront Hall at a very posh place in Belfast. And they had the Tanqueray.
Oh, my goodness gracious. So, bye-bye, Netto Gin. Hello, Tanqueray.
You talk to the bar staff. because they're generally students. They're quite happy to be chatted to. They're patronised by most of the people who
the
are there.
The patrons.
And they're the ones that decide how strong your gin and tonic is. So they're good people to know. So I had my gin and tonic that was almost neat Tanqueray. And I was looking at this god-awful stick painting thing. And somebody came up and said, oh, what do you think? And I said, oh, it's very powerful. And there are bold strokes. And there is a big slash of red across it, which it's a very powerful suicide motif. I was making up all this bollocks on the fly. And this bloke said, no. It's just a stick figure. No, there's a much deeper meaning. It means
You were in full flow by this point, yeah.
I was in full. No, there's a much deeper meaning to this. You're underestimating the insight of the artist. He just turned around and said, I am the artist. Will you have sex with me? Well, thank you for the offer. I'm happy with the gin.
Right. So sometimes the bollocks doesn't work.
We've come really off topic on that one.
We have. And at this point...
Final thoughts. This is an utterly brilliant piece of television.
It is.
It will make you examine other television of the era. It will make you examine modern television. It is massively thought-provoking. And I think the fact that we've rambled on so much about other stuff just demonstrates how thought-provoking this is.
That does sound like the most incredible bollocks, but in actual fact, that is deadly true in this case. And I don't shy away from the fact it sets us off talking about modern television. It sets us off talking about the way things are in the 21st century, the stuff that we are spoon-fed, and we are. Audiences up and down the country... Neither Simon nor me, we don't follow the soaps, we don't watch reality TV, we don't watch talent shows. It's just not our thing. Vast, vast swathes, millions and millions of viewers up and down the country love this stuff. They lap it up. It is spoon feeding you. There's no thought involved. It is switch off television. I just want something to escape to on a Saturday night that I don't need to think about.
Watch this. Watch the machine stops. It predicts everything in the media that's happening at the moment.
And with that, boys and girls, we're going to sign very, very, I would say cheerfully off. It is cheerfully because we have unashamedly given a love letter and a kiss to the 1960s and television of this ilk. Because it is so wonderful.
But and if you have any interest in television at all, or actually any interest in history, because it's a wonderful historical document, find this. Watch it. You will not be disappointed. This is one of the best pieces of television I've ever seen.
Cannot deny any of that. So on that note, boys and girls, thank you so much for listening. We have gone on a lot longer than we intended to, but everything we've said is from the heart. This is exactly why we watch archive television. We shall be back next time with something probably a little more lighthearted, but it's all from the heart. Thank you for listening, everyone.
Bye now.
The Exton-Moss experiment featured Simon Exton and Ken Moss. All featured soundtracks are the property of their respective producers, and no infringement of copyright is intended. Title music was performed by the BBC Symphony Orchestra, and the programme was produced by Maverick Productions. For more information, please visit maverickproductionsuk.blogspot.com or find us on social media.